Psalm 119, verse 49. Remember the word to your servant upon which you have caused me to hope. This is my comfort in my affliction, for your word has given me life. The proud have me in great derision, yet I do not turn aside from your law. I remember your judgments of old, O Lord, and have comforted myself. Indignation has taken hold of me because of the wicked who forsake your law. Your statutes have been my songs. In the house of my pilgrimage, I remember your name in the night, O Lord, and I keep your law. This has become mine because I keep your precepts. You are my portion, O Lord. I have said that I would keep your words. I entreated your favor with my whole heart. Be merciful to me according to your word. I thought about my ways and turned my feet to your testimonies. I made haste and did not delay to keep your commandments. The cords of the wicked have bound me, but I have not forgotten your law. At midnight I will raise to give thanks to you because of your righteous judgments. I am a companion of all who fear you and of those who keep your precepts. The earth, O Lord, is full of your mercy. Teach me your statutes. You have dealt well with your servant, O Lord, according to your word. Teach me good judgment and knowledge, for I believe your commandments. Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. You are good and do good. Teach me your statutes. The proud have forged a lie against me, but I will keep your precepts with my whole heart. Their heart is as fat as grease, but I delight in your law. It is good for me that I have been afflicted, that I may learn your statutes. The law of your mouth is better to me than thousands of coins of gold and silver. So we're looking at verses 57 through 64 today, which is interesting, kind of just a weird coincidence. This is the eighth stanza with eight verses, and today is the eighth Sunday of 2022. And in this stanza, he uses eight terms for the Word of God. It's kind of interesting. We're not going to necessarily go through these perspectives here, but it was interesting to notice David Dickinson sees eight marks of sound belief in this section. Those that have genuinely placed their faith and trust in God have certain qualities that show forth when they go through life, especially when they enter into times of testing, and whether it was sin or the affliction of the wicked, there are things here that demonstrate that this was genuine. There is a certain solitude to the first part of the passage, and so it demonstrates a genuineness of heart. There's nobody here to impress. It's his heart speaking to God. He's not addressing others so much. And in times of difficulty and struggle, sometimes we do feel isolated. And there is a value to getting alone. And sometimes, you know, we've had big families in our church, and you have kids, and you always have little ones that are trying to get your attention for one thing or another, whether positively or negatively, needing direction. And sometimes that aspect of our life kind of gets crowded out. And it's something that we ought to also try to instill in our kids, that it's okay to be quiet. It's okay not to be overstimulated. We don't always have to have the TV on. We don't always have to have the radio on. We don't always have to have the distractions. But there's times when we need to quiet ourselves and be alone with God, especially when we've gotten in trouble, we've done something wrong, and it's not necessarily a bad thing to, in the process of discipline, have them go to their room and have an opportunity to think about what they have done. And as parents, we kind of have to teach them how to relate with God, that we're not just sending you to your room to be alone because we, you know, we can't stand you for a while, you know, or too angry to deal with you, but rather that it's a time where you need to examine your heart, you need to get your perspective right, and you need to take this up with God. You have broken the rules. You've sinned. You need to take this before God on your own and ask His forgiveness. It wasn't just a sin against the family. It was a sin against God. And so we see this aspect of kind of an isolation here. It's His heart and God's heart through the first, more than first half of this passage. It says, "You are my portion, O Lord." You could see that the "you are" in italics, so it's not actually in the original text. It's provided to us. You take that out, and it becomes more of an exclamation. It's a strong declaration. There's a great emotion that is behind this. There's a sense that there is nothing else, that God is all that He has. And he's exclaiming that back to God. The word portion there is a part or a share, a tract of land, a possession, or an inheritance. Think about inheritance for a little bit here. I think Bill said a couple of weeks ago that he's like five generations poor. And that was the story of our life too. Growing up, we had no anticipation of an inheritance. The family joke was that we're going to inherit the bills that are left over, you know. And as a kid, not understanding all that, I was like, oh, man. Some of those bills, when you die, you know, they get taken care of. But we kind of joke even today that the only thing we're going to get is to clean up a mess, you know, that all of the stuff that's gotten collected and shoved in the shed or the backyard or whatever has to be dealt with sometime. And obviously nobody's dealing with it now, so it's going to fall on somebody else. And so what do you have to look forward to, right? We don't live with an anticipation of inheriting a great estate or a great house or money or anything like that. And we don't live in a culture like Israel was. The inheritance was a very big deal. Going back to Abraham and following, this was the oldest son got a double portion of the inheritance, but you know, everything was going to be divided up. And God has placed his blessing upon them as they walked with the Lord. And generally speaking, they would have something to be passing on to the next generation if they had followed after God. But the land was important. Can anybody think of a Bible story that demonstrates the importance of the land as an inheritance? Okay. There was some daughters. If their dad had passed, you know, where did they fall in the inheritance? Is his name wiped out? And God made provision for them. Okay. The story of Ruth. Right. I think of another one. There wasn't any land for them at that point. The promise was there, attached to them. But it was a big element there that he gave up his birthright. and the blessing. There's a certain king that wanted a vineyard. Okay, Ahab, and he pouted on his bed, right? Because why? Naboth did not want to give up his inheritance. This is my portion. This is my family's land. This is my part of the promised land. It's been in our family for generations, and it's going to be passed on to my kids. You know, it was a very big deal to him. It wasn't, just the king's going to provide for me. He's going to give me another place. This was his. And there was a real ownership to it. And so we look here, and David says, "You are my portion, O Lord." As we think of an inheritance, a lot of times we think of something that is yet future, anticipated. But really, the idea goes beyond that. It's what has been in our possession. If it's in the future, it's in our possession by right. But that land was inherited land. Everyone that was living in the land was living in his portion. And it was his inheritance. It was his present possession. And so we see that it's not that when we read that verse, we're not just looking forward to someday out there being in the presence of God, that I'm going to eventually inherit eternity. I'm going to eventually be in heaven. I'm eventually going to be able to fellowship with God. David's saying, no, this is my portion right now. This is mine. And you can see those possessive elements as you study through the Psalms, and we've seen it some here, even the last verse of the last section. This has become mine because I keep your precepts. And so we saw that kind of referred back to the hope and the other things that were brought out in that whole section. But he has in his possession right now an eternal hope. And now in this verse, he has right now God is his possession. Let's look at Numbers 18 and verse 20. Somebody could read that for us.
Then the Lord said to Aaron,
am I the only one that would struggle if I was placed in that situation? Here, all of the tribes of Israel are inheriting the promised land. Everybody's going to have a chunk of soil to work and develop and make a living on and pass on to the next generation. And they have this sense of this is God's blessing in their life. And God says, you Levites, you don't get any possession in the land. Isn't that kind of hard? The flesh would look at that and kind of rebel against that, right? Never mind the fact that what God gave to them was a greater possession than a piece of earth. He gave them himself. God chose out the tribe of Levi as the tithe of all of the people of the land. He set them aside as his possession, but in that process, he also made himself theirs. They had such a great privilege, a great opportunity to be able to serve the Lord, to dedicate their life to the study of the law, to dedicate their life to serving in the tabernacle and teaching the word. These were those that had the privilege of coming into the holy place. These were people who were able to dwell that much closer to the very presence of God in the Holy of Holies than anybody else in the land. And what happened to them? They've been given this tremendous possession. They have God. Did they do any better than everybody else? A few of you are shaking your heads. Yeah. The sinful heart, though they were dwelling that much closer to God, did not change their sinful hearts. And you can point to other examples of that as well. I mean, we just studied there in 1 Kings where the priest was removed from office. You go into the prophets and God pulls back the curtain on the temple and the corruption and the wickedness that was inside there. You go to Nehemiah and they're selling favors and storage space in the temple to gain political points. I mean, they had such an opportunity and they didn't appreciate it. It didn't turn their hearts. But as you look at that, God chose them out, separated them, He made them His own, but at the same time, it's not this idea of owning a tractor or something. He brought them into a relationship, and a relationship is reciprocal. He made them His, and in doing that, He made Himself theirs. And this demonstrates how our relationships ought to be when we get married. Right? We don't maintain an overlord of the household personality, but we give ourselves to one another. It's a reciprocal relationship. Psalm 142:5. You can read that.
I cried out to you, O Lord. I said, you are my refuge.
Okay, if you look back to the title here, what's going on? Why was this short little psalm written? David was in a cave. Did he like caves? Was he a spelunker?
Sure,
he was
hiding.
Okay. He was hiding. Okay. And at this point in time, what did he own? Okay. He had nothing. He had the promise that he would be king. He has the promise of all of the word of God and the law. But what he had in his possession in that moment was very little. And this is a comfort to us when things aren't going well and we suffer losses in life, whether it's losses of loved ones, a spouse or something, or losses financially. And there could come a time of persecution where we have to walk away from everything. We don't know. That kind of thing has happened down through history. But if that happens, we have to tell ourselves, my portion isn't this house. My portion isn't this person. My portion isn't this bank account. My portion is the Lord. How is that a comfort to us? It can't be taken away. My house can burn down. A tornado can ruin. I can go bankrupt and lose everything. My loved ones could die. They can die suddenly, unexpectedly. Everything in this life could be removed from me. I could be injured and not be able to enjoy all of the things that God has allowed me to own. But this cannot be taken from me. My relationships may fall apart because of the sinfulness of man's heart. I can fail in my own sinfulness. But this is not going to be taken away from me. God is my portion. Psalm 73, verse 21. Verses 21 through 26. This is a wonderful psalm. I think it's something we struggle with in life. He got his eyes off of God. He got to looking around. He saw the prosperity of the wicked. And we, you know, drive around in this world and we see people building new houses and we see people driving new vehicles and everybody has something that we don't have. And we can easily get our eyes off of God and become discouraged and even bitter, frustrated, and bitter towards God even, because, you know, why isn't God blessing me? I'm working my tail off, I'm trying to do what's right, and here this crook just took somebody for, you know, $500,000. And he has to get a change of perspective. As he's looking at the things of this world, he's got to remember, this is not my portion. I'm just a pilgrim. I'm not home. This isn't my land. A fancy house, fancy car, money in the bank, that's not what God has given to me. It's not my portion. My portion is God's. So David goes from hiding in a cave and owning nothing to being what? Kids, what did David become? He became a king. And as a king, where did he live? Did he live in a cave? No. Kings live in palaces, right? They build themselves houses. And they make them really fancy. And he had an army of men that would follow him. And so David's gone from having nothing to now David has everything. And he's got to guard his heart because of the wealth that he is now experiencing could lead his heart astray. And he's reminding himself, all of this doesn't mean anything. The only thing that really has any meaning is God. God is my portion. What is it that we desire? We all have desires, don't we? We're living here in this world. We're being advertised to every day. It stirs up a desire in our heart. And the desire in and of itself is not necessarily wrong. It's when we begin to worship that, when we begin to pursue that as our portion rather than pursuing a relationship with God. But we have desires, and our desires can lead us astray. Is God, as our portion, sufficient to offset the desires of this fleshly world? What about God is able to help us put off the discouragement or the lust or the fill in the blank that we get as we look at the things of this world? Okay. Peace and joy that come only from Him. Okay. And we know that intellectually, something that lasts forever has got to be better than something that rots. But how hard is it for us to live in that waiting? Because the best things are yet to come, whereas we can have pleasures now. Riches make very poor comforters, don't they? I thought I had this up next, but I'm probably getting ahead of myself a little bit, but I think it fits here in our thought process. How many movie stars are married to one person for life? There's some out there. But that's not what we think of when we think of a movie star. You look at the extreme wealthy. They've got the boats and yachts on the ocean, and they've got houses in multiple cities. And relationships, whoever they want, whenever they want them. Right? And all of that, does it really satisfy them? Is it a comfort to them? They can be some of the most miserable people. There's a book out there that I'd like to read sometime because it just kind of triggers my curiosity. The title of it is Your Money or Your Life. But in terms of our thinking today, think of it as Satan would like to offer us not our money or our life, but our money or our God. And how tempting it is to take a pile of earthly riches and hold them out before somebody and say, all you have to do is forget God. You can have all of this, just don't walk in fellowship with Him. And when we sit there and intellectually think of it, we know what the right choice is. Forget the riches of life and follow God. Develop a relationship. Walk in fellowship with God. But this is what is being done on a daily basis in a very subtle way in our life. Oftentimes, as success comes, it comes with a temptation to allow our relationship with God to become cool and cold and eventually nearly non-existent. How did Satan tempt Jesus? Yeah. Of all that Satan had, he offered Jesus a portion of this earthly good. Food to satisfy his hunger. Pride of prestige and power, and a kingdom on earth. He offers up temporal things to break our relationship with God. He offers us a portion. And we've got to deny the portion that Satan offers us and claim and cling to the portion which is our Heavenly Father. And a lot of that is an anticipation of eternity. But as we were mentioning earlier, it's our present possession. That my walking in fellowship with God is so dear to me. It is so valued to me that I would choose this over anything. Whatever my possessions are, I would give them up if I can have close fellowship with God. Whatever the opportunities of life that would present themselves, I would choose God today rather than these things. That's the perspective that David was developing in his life. God is my portion right now. I can be fully satisfied, content, comforted, joy, as Deanne pointed out, because God is mine. You know, possessions make poor comforters, they become hard masters. So why is God the best possession? He's eternal, okay? Everything else that we look at is going to one day rot, destroy, or be burned. He never changes. He's faithful today, tomorrow. He'll be faithful at the end of my life. Yeah. He can help us. Our God is all powerful. There's nothing too hard for Him. He never leaves us. Is there anything else? Those are very comforting things. He makes Himself available to us, doesn't He? Why would eternal God, who is a creator of all things, humble himself to care about what I'm feeling today? But he does. Why would he help me? You know, it's not like my problems are earth-shattering, you know, geopolitical problems that are going to change the course of the world. But he's willing to help me with the little frustrations of my life. He's willing to help me when I'm having just a bad day, when I have a bad attitude. He's willing to help me when I haven't been faithful to him. God is the best portion. David, in saying this, is setting the Lord before himself. Psalm 16 and verse 8.
I've set the Lord always before me.
Okay. And kind of see some connections to this morning's message. You know, the wise man keeps the word and does it. He memorizes it, he searches it, he lives it out. And he is the wise man building his house upon a rock. And here we set him before us. And that's what he's doing. He's saying, Lord, you are my portion. I'm focusing all of my heart's attention and desires upon you rather than setting them upon the things of this earth. He's setting him before his face. And therefore, he is not going to be moved. He says, I would keep your word. It's interesting that you go back to the last, I think it was the last octave. Yep, 49. Remember your word to your servant. He wants to remember all of God's word. There's nothing to be added to it. But here he is remembering some very specific words from himself. We can't go and say that I want to remember everything that I've ever said. Because there's a lot of things that I've said that I should never have said. And I've said things that in ways that I should never have said them. But there are some things that we say that we need to remember. And this is those points in time where we have made a commitment to God. He's looking back and he says, I said that I would keep your words. Did he do that? No. Right? I mean, that's the whole tension in this psalm. His desire to keep the word, his intent to keep the word, his commitment to keep the word. But he gets to the end. He says, I've gone astray like a lost sheep. But even when our lives are this way, because of the sinfulness of our hearts, we ought to be bringing back to mind those points of commitment. I can remember back in high school. I think we were seniors, went to senior high camp. Ken Rudolph, I think, was the speaker. And his message was about presenting our lives to God as though it was a blank page. And everybody made a commitment that night. Right? I mean, he was just a very powerful speaker, and he moved a lot of people. And I wonder how many of those would remember that commitment. But how many times have I had to go back to the truths that he taught there about giving God a blank page, saying, God, whatever you want to do, however you want to write the story of my life, it's yours. You can write it. And I take that page back. I said, no, let's just a second. I got an eraser here. I don't like this line. Okay, change that. You can have it back now. Or wait a second, God, I want to write something. And we have to go back to those points in time where we said, this is my commitment to you. I am committed to following after your word. I've wandered from that commitment, but I come back to it. I set it. It's the heart's desire. I want to do this. And I come back to this. And then he says, I entreat your favor with my whole heart. The word entreat has the idea of being weak or sick or being without strength. And that's where they get the idea of begging. You come without any strength. You know, not even enough strength to stand up. A beggar is lying at your feet, right? He's grabbing on to your legs and saying, please do this for me. And so he's begging God for something. He's begging him for favor. And the word favor there is the Hebrew word for face. He wants God to look at him. He wants a relationship. He wants to be face to face with God. That's what we want when we have relationships between our family members, right? Wish the kid would just get off the computer and have a conversation. Look me in the face. Pay attention. I'm telling you something. But the idea of God looking and placing his face toward us is the idea of placing a blessing upon us. His goodness. His favor. His face, in this case, is not angry, but it is a loving kindness. But as soon as he says that, what's he follow that up with? It's right there. Huh? After he asks God to, he entreats God for his favor, what comes next in the passage? His mercy. Because as soon as God looks at us, the light of his countenance exposes. Be merciful to me. He has to plead his mercy. I don't deserve your favor. I've sinned against you. I desire your favor. I want you to look upon my life. I want your blessing upon my life. But as soon as I contemplate your looking at me, I am made very aware of my sinfulness. Give me mercy. Then he says that he has thought about his ways. I thought about my ways and turned my feet to your testimonies. This reminds us of the story of the prodigal son. And remember, he's wasted his living, and he's now sitting there with the pigs, wanting to eat the slop that he's giving to the pigs. And what's he think? He comes to his senses. The whole life of sin was not a reasonable life, but he comes to his senses. He's now able to reason, and he reasons that the slaves in my father's house have better food to eat and clothes on their back than I've got right here. I've sinned. And once he reasoned and thought about his life and condition, then what did he do? He got up and he went to his father. And that's what we see in this passage. He says, I have contemplated my life. I have thought about me, who I am, my sinfulness, the way I have gotten out of the right path. And when I have stopped and thought about myself and saw myself in light of God's word, his truth, his holiness, I turned my feet back into the right way. And this is where we need some time to be alone. We need some time to turn off the TV and the radio and sit quietly and contemplate ourself and our relationship with God and to see that we have gotten out of his way. And if we love him and he is our portion, we're going to quickly turn and walk back into the right way. We don't wait around. He says, I did not delay. Sometimes we delay in getting right with God out of fear or self-pity or self-will, a certain rebelliousness in us. I know I'm wrong, but I want to be wrong. I want this. And we sit there and we don't hurry back into the presence of God. David says, I hurried back. I don't know if you've ever, especially as a kid, gotten someplace where all of a sudden you realized you're where you shouldn't be, or all of a sudden you don't recognize where you're at, or you maybe recognize that all of a sudden you're alone, mom and dad are gone. What do you do? Is there this sense of panic? Urgency. Run back to where I last saw them. Let's remember leaving kids behind. It's happened a few times. Fortunately, some of those times they were old enough to, you know, they weren't going to get hurt or anything. But leaving them behind and not even realizing that you had the responsibility of having that child. And I can't imagine what was going through their minds. Panic. And that's what we ought to have, a desire. When we suddenly realize we're outside of fellowship with God, it ought to panic us and we ought to run back to Him as quickly as we can. He says, the cords of the wicked have bound me. This is a terminology of using a snare or a net. Being trapped, and when you get trapped, there's a certain element of injury. It says, at midnight I will rise to give thanks to you because of your righteous judgments. Believers who are in a relationship with God love His judgment. And they sing at night as they think about God's judgment. A sinner does not sing when he thinks of God's judgment. It terrifies him. But one that is walking in fellowship with God is able to contemplate the judgment of God with joy, knowing he's been forgiven. Up to this point, it's been solitary. Now he turns his attention to his companionship. I am a companion of all who fear you and those who keep your precepts. What was done in the solitary moments of his life, in his heart between him and God, has made him ready for companionship. And he's choosing the right companionship, and he loves the right companionship. You know, a lot of times the world looks at believers and think, oh, what a bunch of dull people. They don't drink, they don't smoke, they don't party, they don't dance, they don't. And for them to be in the company of a bunch of believers makes them very uncomfortable. They don't want to be there. But for a believer who is in fellowship with God, who's getting his heart right with God, he's setting God as his portion, setting God before him, he's meditating upon God in the night seasons, singing in his heart because of his relationship with God. He comes into a fellowship of believers and he just loves it. He eats it up because these are his people. I am a companion of all who fear you. The earth, O Lord, is full of your mercy. Teach me your statutes. No matter how far one has run out of the way of where he is supposed to be, he is still not beyond the ready presence of God's mercy and faithful love. The whole earth is filled with his faithful love. And so he is our portion.